I'm Sam Litzinger. We have a winner at Wimbledon.
It is official. A changing of the guard at Wimbledon.
22-year-old Rafael Nadal overcame the weather and skillful play
Buzz,
by Roger Federer to win the men's singles at Wimbledon. It was a day of stops and starts with the rain interrupting play twice. The Swiss maestro fought hard, coming back after two sets down before Nadal took the title. After nearly 5 hours of nail-biting play, the crowd rose to their feet as the Spaniard claimed victory. It'll go down in history as Wimbledon's longest men's single and one of the greatest. Amy Gutman, CBS News, London.
NBC Sports carried the match. Nearly 2,700 homes in Santa Barbara County, California are threatened by the huge wildfire that's headed their way. CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman is on the ground and in the air. Firefighters are doing their best to head the flames off, and cooler weather is helping them.
The fire is burning in some very, very difficult areas to access, some mountainous areas which are very difficult to get fire crews to, and this is making the air assault even more important.
Officials think the fire was started by humans, intentionally or not, they don't know. They're asking for the public's help in finding out who did it. At least 330 wildfires are burning out of control around California. John McCain and Barack Obama have had a foreign policy debate by proxy. Here's CBS News correspondent Tom Foti.
The candidate's surrogate soundbite battle focused on Barack Obama and Iraq. Has he flip-flopped by saying he'd go there, listen to military commanders, and then adjust his Iraq plans? McCain supporter Senator Lindsey Graham.
He is in a bind. He said things that didn't bear fruit, and he doesn't know how to change. Al-Qaeda's on their knees. Iran's being contained.
Obama supporter and ex-presidential candidate John Kerry turned the Iraq focus on John McCain.
He has a plan for staying in Iraq, and Barack Obama has a plan for getting out of Iraq.
Senators Kerry and Graham there on CBS's Face the Nation. Tom Foti, CBS News, Washington.
OPEC's chief says you'd better get used to high oil prices. They're going to be with us a long time. He tells a conference in Algiers strong market demand, especially from China and India, will keep prices high. He also blames a weak U.S. dollar because that's the currency oil is sold in. It's a crime that's becoming more widespread as gas prices soar. Thieves siphoning gas out of your vehicle. Christy Hyde with AAA says it's something else for drivers to worry about, but there are things you can do to keep your gasoline in your tank.
Many of today's cars have the fuel door, has a locking mechanism that can only be opened on the inside. So one thing can be as easy as making sure you keep your car locked so that no one can open the door and unlock your fuel door.
Also, be careful where you park your car so that you don't end up making it a lot easier for thieves to get at your gasoline. This is CBS News.
Did you know that Geico insures more than cars? It's true, they cover tons of other things like hot air balloons, unicycles and roller skates. Nah, I'm just messing with you. But Geico can help insure lots of other vehicles though, like motorcycles, RVs, ATVs, personal watercraft, boats and pogo sticks. I'm only kidding about the pogo sticks, but seriously, just so there's no confusion, Geico now offers insurance on more than just your car.
Geico, saving you money on insurance for your car and the other stuff that moves you. Visit Geico.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO.
As the price of gas continues to rise, so does the number of fuel-saving experts. Look, the guys at Advanced Auto Parts aren't scientists inventing hydrogen engines or cellulosic ethanol. They got their PhDs in parts. Stuff like air filters, fuel filters, spark plugs, fuel system cleaners, and other things that make cars run more efficiently. Look, if you really want to save money on gas, go buy a bike. Otherwise, head on over to Advanced Auto Parts. They'll show you how to get more miles per gallon. Whatever you're working on, Advanced will help you keep the wheels turning.
What's a typical Monday for you? How about Monday at a fiesta? Or a Monday strolling white sand beaches and vibrant boulevards? Maybe a Monday cruising along the Gold Coast of Mexico? Heck, how about Monday doing anything from scuba diving to hiking or parasailing or shopping or napping? Or you could spend the entire day lying by the pool or dining in any of up to as many as 14 different dining options and 11 bars and lounges on board. Those are the kind of Mondays you can expect with freestyle cruising on board Norwegian Cruise Line. And if you think that's great for a Monday, then wait till you see the rest of the week. Take a 7 or 11 day Mexican Riviera cruise this September through April with cruise rates from $4.99 per person. So which one looks better for you? The Monday where you're not free from the daily grind, or the Monday where you're free to whatever? To plan your cruise, call the travel address, Galaxy Cruises, at 559-432-9095. Restrictions apply. Limited time offer. Ships registry United States of America and Bahamas.
Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ. I'm Paul Leffler. Happy to be back in studio this week, last week, and, about for 2 weeks. I was in Omaha, Nebraska with the Bulldogs as they won the national championship at the College World Series. And now back in town, and we've got a great show for you today with a very interesting guest by the name of Ike Aikida. Maybe you know him from around the Valley. Maybe you've read his story in that book, Stories of Service. The Valley remembers World War II. The greatest generation remembers World War II. Or maybe you've seen him at a funeral as part of the Honor Guard, which he's still very active in. But we're going to get to all of Ike's experiences during World War II. Before we do that, I want to make up for a little bit of a goof last week. We had the interview that I recorded in Omaha with an Omaha veteran of World War II, Sam Basili, who was a prisoner of war in two different German prison camps towards the end of World War II. And if you were listening to the show last week, you heard a technical glitch and didn't get to hear the end of Sam's story. So we're going to listen to that before we get to Ike today. So this will be Sam Basili as we finish up his conversation. He was a prisoner of war in Europe. He was a waist gunner on a B-17, shot down, was at Stalag Luft 4. And then when a lot of those POWs got put on that infamous German death march, including a man who's been on this show, Rudy Giannone, if you remember Rudy talking about his experiences on that death march, part of the camp also was sent to another POW camp, and Sam was part of that second contingent, so that's where we'll pick up his story right about now.
Well, the Russians were coming towards our camp in Poland, and they loaded us in boxcars and shipped us to, some of us went to Bart Germany, Stalag Luft 1, and others were on that death march. I was fortunate to go to Stalag Luft 1 in Bart Germany, and I was put in a camp there. That was basically, I think, originally it was an officer's camp. And so I was there with, I know my officer, Jess Brashers, was there. But I didn't see any other of my crew members. And I spent the rest of my time there till in May when the Russians came and liberated us. And they were unhappy because we didn't show enough enthusiasm. They want us to tear everything down, barracks and all. But our officer said, no, our wire down. We've got to have a place to stay. We're going to keep the barracks, and maybe later on somebody else can use them. So we tore 20,000 guys out tearing barbed wire down all at one time, made the Russians happy. And when the Russians came, why, they brought some cattle. I don't know where they got the cattle, and the GIs, they butchered them, and we had hamburger, which was great.
Tasted great, but could your stomach handle it?
They didn't give us very much. That's the whole trouble. They wouldn't give us much.
Well, your stomach wouldn't have been able to digest much after that maggot diet for a few months.
Yeah, when we left, then they come in, they flew us out of the camp there and took us to Lucky Strike, I think, there in France. And then we got a good meal, and I tried to go in twice, and they wouldn't let me go in twice. I was hungry.
And then you got to come home. What was that like when you got to see your family again?
Well, I never called. I was always worried about my mother. I never called, and I just kind of, the only call when I got to Kansas City, I called her and asked my brother if she was okay. She was, so, and then I come home, why, God, she hugged me so hard, I almost strangled me. But it was good to get home and see my brothers and sisters, my dad and my mother, and all my friends.
And you've been in Omaha ever since?
Ever since I've been in Omaha.
Well, and less than a month ago, you got a chance to do something that I hope every veteran of World War II gets a chance to do, to go see the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. as part of the Honor Flight Network that is raising money to pay for veterans to go back there so they don't have to do it on their own dime. What was that like for you? How meaningful was that?
Oh, God, that was just great. I said they started out at everybody met at the Comfort Inn on 72nd and Grover here in Omaha, and they took us. They had a breakfast for us that morning. They took us, but the previous night they had a banquet for us at the Heritage Club here in Omaha. And that morning we left Comfort Inn about 6 o'clock in the morning. They took us to the airport. We didn't go through security. We went right to the plane. They just wanded us real quick and put us on the plane, and we took off for Washington. They had a Boy Scout, an honor guard that met us there. They took us to the World War II Memorial, and there was 500 grade school kids and high school kids from Ohio that made a walkway for us clear into the memorial. They applauded as we went through there. Some of the veterans had tears in their eyes. I was close. They shook your hands as you walked by. It was really a sight to see. Those kids from Ohio is where they're from, not Oklahoma. I get my states mixed up. They were from Ohio. Fantastic kids. I can't believe what happened. And we went to the memorial. We seen the chain. Then we went to the Arlington National Cemetery. We seen the changing of the guard. And then from there, they took us to the Korean and Vietnam Memorial in front of the Lincoln Memorial. And then we wound up at the Iwo Jima. Now that is something to see. And if any of you veterans get the chance to go see this, and all the people there in Fresno, if you get a chance to donate it, donate money for this cause. It's a great cause. You can't beat it. It made us very, very happy. And I want to thank all of you people for allowing us to share our experience with you. You're Americans. You're all wonderful. Thank you.
And thank you to Sam Basile. That was Omaha's Sam Basile. Sam, thank you for your service to our country and for sharing that story with us. And if those of you at home are interested in finding out more about that Honor Flight Network, which raises money to send World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial, while they still have a chance to do that, go to honorflight.org. That's HONORFLIGHT.org. And you can get more information and maybe get some local veterans. And I'll certainly be keeping you posted on any local efforts to get veterans to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. It is definitely worth the trip. Much more to come in this edition of Hometown Heroes. And we trust that Sam and all of his Omaha friends had a happy 4th of July. Hope that you did, too, as we celebrate the freedom paid for by the lives of more than a million American patriots over the last 232 years. More than a million Americans have died for our freedom, 400,000 of them in World War II, and the surviving World War II veterans, to a man, will tell you those are the real heroes, the 400,000 who died during World War II. But here at Hometown Heroes, we like to think that every man or woman who served his country is a hero to us. And we're going to meet one of our hometown heroes, Ike Ikeda, when the program returns right after this on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Every summer, thousands of Valley residents go on vacation, but the need for blood never does. In fact, the summer months are especially crucial for the Central California Blood Center, as the need is often the strongest and donations are usually less. Please take an hour to donate and encourage others to do so, or maybe hold a blood drive to help out. The Central California Blood Center is the sole provider of blood and blood products for the 31 hospitals in Fresno, Tulare, Madera, Kings, and Mariposa counties, and must collect between 5,000 to 6,000 pints of blood monthly to meet the needs of our Valley community. If you're in good general health, weigh a minimum of 110 pounds, and are at least 17 years old, please visit a Central California Blood Center or Bloodmobile near you and give. For more information, call 559-224-2900. That's 559-224-2900. Please, take time to give today.
One change can be riding your bike.
One change can be taking the bus.
One change can be a teleconference.
Hello? One change can be carpooling.
Good morning, guys.
If everyone makes just one change in their lifestyle...
Just one.
We can win the fight against air pollution.
Make one change in your lifestyle during Healthy Air Living Week, July 7th through the 13th, and help clean up our Valley's air. Bicycling to work, carpooling, taking the bus, or using any one of the many ways that will reduce driving is not only good for the air, but with the high cost of gas, it's good for the pocketbook as well. Healthy Air Living is about making air quality decisions a priority in your life. Take the Healthy Air Living Pledge, and you could win a Toyota Prius. For tips and contest rules, visit HealthyAirLiving.com. And be the solution to Valley air pollution.
Together we can beat Valley air pollution.
A message from the Valley Air District.
This
is Hometown Heroes. Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm your host, Paul Leffler. If you want to tell me about a World War II veteran in your life that you think I ought to track down and get on this program, you can email me, paul@kmj580.com. Today we get a chance to talk to Ike Ikeda, who was one of just 5,000 Americans in the service before Pearl Harbor who happened to be of Japanese descent. Just 5,000 Japanese American soldiers before Pearl Harbor. Have you ever heard that number, Ike?
No, I thought it was something over 3,000.
Oh, so I'm going too high.
Yeah, because the draft started in 1940.
Now, you had finished up at Clovis High School. Mm-hmm. What were you up to when Uncle Sam got a hold of you? You decided to join, right?
I was farming with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
I was 2 months too young to sign up for the draft in 1940. You had to be 21 by July, and since my birthday was in September, I wasn't registered.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother, who was 2 years older, was registered, and then also he became 1A in 41.
Mm-hmm.
So our mail carrier, who was on the draft board, we stopped him and asked him that if I volunteered and joined up, whether the board would give my brother a 3A ag deferment, which was quite prevalent then because the war hadn't started yet. Even after the war had started, I know some of the neighbors who are draft eligible got farm deferments, you know.
So you didn't want to be on the farm. You said, my brother can handle that. I'll go work for Uncle Sam.
I tell you, I was just tickled pink to leave the farm.
Tells you how much hard work farming can be, huh? So the mail carrier was on the draft board, and somehow your number got called.
But then the deal was that I would have to volunteer and join up,
mm-hmm.
which I did, you know. So then they gave my brother 3A, ag deferment.
Was your brother glad about that?
Yeah, I think so, because he had been taking over our family operations since he was 17, right after high school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a better farmer than my father was.
But not long after you got in, here you are over at Camp Roberts. I'm sure exhausted when they make you do that 25-mile hike. Although today, I'm sure you can handle it. Ike is a guy who still swims 4 days a week and is a lot younger than his 87 years would tell you. In fact, he's sitting here in a very youthful Fresno State National Championship baseball shirt right now, looking good in red. But at that point, so you're at Camp Roberts, and you'd only been in the service for about a month, right, when Pearl Harbor happened?
That's right.
Tell us about that moment and what that was like. I can't imagine what that must have been like.
Well, of course, that was Sunday. Most of us were hanging around the barracks waiting for, chow call. Of course, before Pearl Harbor, you know, a lot of the guys were going to town. You know, they put their civilian clothes on and go to town and then try to charm some of the local girls. But we were waiting for a chow when the news came over the radio. And it was hard to believe at the time.
Well, I imagine for you, as a Japanese American, you had to feel like there was a big target on your back all of a sudden around the rest of these soldiers.
Yeah, well, the impact hadn't really hit until the day after when President Roosevelt made that declaration of war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but at the same time, we had a very good commanding general at Camp Roberts who stated that you know, there are many GIs of Japanese ancestry here, but he says if I hear of any wrongdoing against them, he says they will have to answer to me. So he set the tone.
What did that mean to you?
Great. We were treated equally all the way through basic training. Some people have asked me, did they give you ammunition? I says, yep, just like the rest. When we went out on the range, we had ammo just like the rest of them.
You had a rifle that was just as old as theirs and outdated, right?
Yeah.
And a World War One helmet.
It was a Springfield Old Three, which was a good rifle.
And it wouldn't be too long after that. So you're in the service for a month. Pearl Harbor happens. Obviously, that changes everything. Then it was only, about 2.5 months after that, that President Roosevelt gave the famous Executive Order 9066, yeah, which paved the way for the Japanese internment.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened to you and to your family at that point.
Well, of course, I was gone. You know, I was in... I had completed my basic training, and we had been sent to Camp Robinson, Arkansas, which is out of Little Rock. In fact, we followed General Mallon, who was the commanding general of Camp Roberts, because he started another infantry training center at Camp Robinson,
mm-hmm,
which had been a National Guard camp. And those boys were the first ones called up, you know, after Pearl Harbor.
Right.
So we tagged along with General Mallon, and so our group got equal treatment as long as we were under his command.
But meanwhile, your brother, who had gotten out of the service when you got in, was back home with the rest of your family running the family farm in the Clovis area.
Yeah.
They were subject to that executive order. They had to relocate. When did you catch wind of that, and how hard was that for you to try to understand what was happening?
Well, of course, I think it was in the spring, but they had the Far Western Defense Command had already set a curfew.
Right.
Because I know my brother got married in April of 42, and so they had to observe the curfew, you know, after the wedding and this and that. And so, of course, initially, Clovis was considered a white zone. They wouldn't have to evacuate. So some of the out-of-towners moved into Clovis, but as it turned out, town by town, they were all evacuated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, I got wind of it when I was in Camp Robinson.
Could you believe it? I can't imagine what that must feel like.
No, not really, because I've always felt that it was an abridgment of the Constitution.
You
and if that be the case, then what good is the Constitution? Because that is the article that we are governed by. And without due process of law, to take law-abiding citizens and throw them into... Actually, they call it relocation centers, but in essence, it was just like a concentration camp. Although as time went on, they were allowed... the younger people were allowed to go out to go to school or get jobs, you know. But you got barbed wire, you got sentries with rifles, you know.
Doesn't feel like freedom.
That's a concentration camp, as far as I'm concerned.
And were you able to be in touch, have contact with your family during that period? What kinds of things were they telling you?
You know, my family got split up with the Clovis Bunch after my brother got married in April. My sister-in-law had two twin sisters who were very young yet. And so they were taken into the Fresno Assembly Center.
Mm-hmm.
And so my sister-in-law, in order to take care of her sisters, had to split with my brother. Shortly after they got married and went to the Fresno Assembly Center, and the Clovis Bunch hadn't been called up yet. So my brother and the rest of the family finally decided, well, they would go ahead and join the Fresno Bunch, you know. And as it turned out, it was maybe two or three months later, Clovis Bunch had to move anyhow. But then the Clovis Bunch went to Poston, Arizona, whereas the Fresno Bunch went to Jerome, Arkansas, you know. But it was kind of fortunate for me because during the time I was at Camp Robinson, I was able to hop on a train and go down to Jerome to visit them.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Yeah, which wouldn't have happened if they had gone to post him with the rest of the bunch.
I imagine as happy as you were to get that chance to see him, that had to be difficult to ride up to a situation like that and then to be leaving.
Yeah, it just, well, I've often wondered what my reaction would have been if I were at home instead of in the service at that time. I've told many of my friends, I would probably be rotten in jail yet.
Because you wouldn't have taken it easily.
Being young and, you know, brainless, no telling what I would have done. I've often wondered about it. I just don't know.
Have you seen American Pastime?
Yes, I have.
That's for those of you who haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's a movie that Kerio Nakagawa, a local historian and author and researcher, was a big part of putting together. It was his brainchild, and just a terrific film. And I think that really captures kind of what you're talking about, the different attitudes of the Japanese Americans who were put in camps like that. And you see how some of it, you know, tried to do their best to deal with it, make the best of it. For others, it really was a struggle, and they wanted to fight back and not take this lying down. And it sounds like you would have been one of the latter. You wouldn't have just complied with everything they told you.
I kind of doubt it. Yeah, I have grave doubts about it.
Meanwhile, here you are wearing a uniform for the U.S. Army. So, in essence, you're fighting for a country that's holding your family captive.
That's right.
How do you reconcile that in your brain, and how did you keep going and doing your job without getting in trouble?
Well, after the initial shock, and then after we were able to somewhat accept the situation, we figured that would be the only way we could prove our loyalty, that color didn't matter, that we were just as good as Americans as anybody else by serving, you know. And by the same token, I give probably the biggest credit to the guys who volunteered from the concentration camps, or let's say the relocation centers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Here, because different people have asked me in the service, you know, how do you feel about it, you know. So then I would just turn around and tell them, well, supposing they took your dad and mom and threw them into a concentration camp just because of their, you know, ethnic background, mm-hmm. You know, how would you feel? Well, that would be the end of the conversation. There's no more questions asked.
That kind of gets the point across.
I was asked many times from guys from all over different parts of the United States, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know I met a bunch from Pennsylvania, those hardcore coal miners. They shook their head and said, yeah, I can't believe it.
Yeah, they had to respect what you were doing. Well, we need to catch a commercial break here, but when we come back, we'll find out what Ike Ikeda did in the service during World War II while his family was back in that relocation camp in Arkansas. And had some pretty interesting experiences that he had during the war. We'll also talk about some of the things that he's up to now. So that's up next as Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Hi. Hey, you know the three little pigs? I'm the guys who built with straw, sticks, and bricks. Well, I'm the fourth little pig, and I build with steel. Yep, I use Miracle Truss. Hey, that brick place kept the wolf out, but a little earthquake took that sucker right down. Miracle Truss is lighter and stronger than other steel buildings. Talk about hopping and popping. Miracle Truss buildings can take hurricane force winds. From a small workshop to a large commercial structure, any length, it's the best, which is why it's got the best warranty. Hey, don't wait for the price of steel to climb another 30%. Order now and you can defer delivery. Just go to MiracleTrust.com or call 1-877-51-TRUST. That's 1-877-51-TRUSS. Call now and you'll get the manufacturer's price. I did. And they call the pig who built the brick house smart. Yeah, oink. Call 1-877-51-TRUST now.
It's once again time to go to Ray Appleton's favorite place in the world. It'll be the sixth time to fly off to French Polynesia and the islands of Tahiti. February of 2009, yeah, we're going to do it again. The very sacred and religious cultural island, the old island of Raiatea. Then we go off to the party island of Taha'a. And then a couple of days at Bora Bora. There's the stuff of legend and even history of World War II. And then my favorite place in the world of all the places that I've been to. The island, a couple of days on Mo'orea. This is the most beautiful place the good Lord has ever created. Make sure you take this trip with me on the Paul Gauguin. Believe me, I know you're being pinched. We have made this so affordable. It's a quick trip. It's only 1 week this time. Call Lewis Travel and Cruises immediately. 431-1800. 559-431-1800. There is so much more I could tell you, but I don't have the time. They will. 431-1800. Call now.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Lafler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That music more times than you can count, and I think that goes for today's guest, Ike Ikeda, as well. If you are just tuning in, Ike is a World War II veteran from Clovis who joined the service about a month before the attacks on Pearl Harbor. He's a Japanese American, one of just a little more than 3,000 in the service before the war. Of course, after that, after the Japanese internment, after the internment, a lot of Nisei soldiers came about, joined the service. In fact, so many of them became part of the famous 442nd, the Gopher Broke unit, and Ike made reference to that in our last segment. There is a great history center that I think you're familiar with, too, down in Los Angeles. And if any of you at home want to check out, they have more than 500 Nisei veterans stories archived online there as part of the Hanashi Oral History Project. That is gopherbroke.org if you want to take a look at that. Have you been down there to see that monument, Ike?
Yes, I have, yeah. Didn't have too much time, but then I did get a chance to look at it.
They have the Gopher Broke National Monument down in the Los Angeles area. So if you want more information on that, gopherbroke.org. Now let's continue talking to Ike about his experiences during the war. If you didn't hear it earlier, his family, of course, after Executive Order 9066 on February 19th of 1942, paved the way for the internment of Japanese Americans on the West Coast. 120,000 of them would be interned. That included his family, which was sent to Jerome, Arkansas. Meanwhile, he is in the service of the U.S. Army, and they decided to send you to the China-Burma-India Theater, right?
Yes, that's right.
What kind of tricks were you up to?
Well, actually, I was in military intelligence, and I went over with a group of 10. In fact, most of the teams that came out of the intelligence center were in teams of 10. And we were on detached service. In other words, we didn't belong to our own company except just at headquarters. And then, so generally there was two of us assigned to the various groups. In fact, I ended up in China, and our job was, when we were attached to the Chinese unit, was to help them try to keep the Japanese troops in China, where they had been stationed since 1937, when they invaded China and took all the major cities. So some of the guys had to do behind the line work. They called it OSS, Office of Strategic Services, and our main job was to translate captured documents, interrogate the POWs to see what we were up against, you know, in terms of what unit, and, you know, how many. And then I know one of our guys got captured by the Japanese Army about a week before BJ. But he happened to be from Hawaii. And, you know, there's a lot of mixed blood there.
Right.
And it was hard to tell exactly what he was, of what origin. So he passed himself off as a Chinese American. But he was really sweating it out, you know. And
then, that worked for him, huh?
Yeah, it did. Well, good thing, you know, VJ came along, you know, within a week's time. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think he would have been in trouble. Yeah.
Now, this sounds like really intriguing work that you were doing here, and pretty important work to the overall cause. If you're trying to determine where troop concentrations are, what the Japanese are up to, you talked about interrogation, and obviously that's a subject that in today's world has been in the news quite a bit, and a little bit of a controversial subject. When you're interrogating a Japanese prisoner of war, what was that experience like? I imagine it wasn't all straightforward. Everyone was different, I'm sure.
Everybody had different approaches. We had one guy, he wasn't in our group, but he was in another group, and I understand he used to kind of slap him around, you know, which was really not the American GI way, you know. We weren't supposed to, you know, manhandle any of the POWs, you know. There's been quite a controversy during this Iraq war about some undue pressure we put on prisoners, you know. So, of course, like you say, each POW was different. We had to handle them differently, you know. And because our army had a list of their divisions, various units. So if we could find out what unit he belonged to, and then where they were based and whatnot, we could get a lot of information in order to, to fight back at him, you know. So that was our main duty, you know.
But that information wasn't necessarily easy to glean from them or easy to pull out of them.
Not that easy, yeah.
What kind of motivational tricks did you use? How did you get them to talk?
Well, try to be fairly decent. Then cigarettes are always a pretty good, you know, because we always had cigarettes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know one of the fellas, he was talking to this POW for quite some time, and he was kind of rough to him at first, you know. He didn't manhandle him or didn't lay his hands on him, you know, but the prisoner has stated, well, boy, you know, I sure miss eating something that grew around there, you know. So the next time Ben went to talk to him, he took some of that stuff along with him. And the prisoner told him in Japanese, he says, here, I thought you were a devil, and you turned out to be an angel, you know.
And then he was singing like a canary, huh?
He was able to get the information out of him, you know, but it was quite a story, really.
Well, I would imagine, too, especially you being of Japanese heritage, that when you are interrogating these Japanese soldiers who are now your prisoners, that they probably shouted a few not-so-nice things at you and probably weren't the most polite in the world to you.
No, not really.
No, they were okay.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, they kept their cool. Yeah, really.
No one ever spit at you or yelled at you or anything like that? Thank the Lord.
I think about that time, you know, because, see, Japan, like I say, went into China in 1937. So a lot of those guys had been in the army for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 6-7 years, you know. In fact, we met my wife's cousin the first time we went to Japan, and he was in the army for 7 years.
Mm.
You know, during the start from the beginning, wounded 3-4 times, had malaria 4 times, got sunk on a boat 3 times, and still survived.
That's a survivor.
Yeah.
And you know, for the most part, all the veterans that I speak with, American veterans, regardless of their ethnicity, and obviously there were some war crimes, and they were prosecuted for that, and what, you know, the Bataan Death March, and some of those were just atrocities. But the rank-and-file Japanese soldiers, all I ever hear from the American veterans is that they had the utmost respect for them,
mm-hmm.
and they appreciated their dedication to their cause, even if it wasn't the same cause.
Yeah.
It sounds like maybe you felt that way, too, that you respected them?
the troops, nobody goes to war because they want to.
Exactly.
It's the governments get into the war, then you're a victim of that, you know. I think there's just sort of a, well, in the process, there is sort of a mutual respect. Of course, you're trying to do away with each other, too.
Yeah.
As far as that goes,
it's a fine line to walk there.
It's a matter of survival.
Amen. And in addition to the interrogations, another thing that you have spoken about, interpreting documents were captured?
We did a certain amount of interpreting for the brass.
Anything stand out there? Anything that you interpreted that you remember?
No, nothing of importance. Although I did talk briefly with, he was a major general in the Southern Chinese Army. In fact, he was in charge of the, he was the commanding general of the, they call it Kim Pei Tai, which is similar to our MPs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they had a little bit more power, and they were a little bit more rougher than our MPs.
I imagine every once in a while maybe something came across your desk that they wanted you to interpret, and it turned out to be absolutely nothing of importance at all, and maybe even something that was funny that they asked you to interpret it?
Well, it all depended upon the situation. You know, there's a military term that expresses that, says it depending upon the conditions, you know.
Right.
That's kind of a favorite term that they use.
Mm-hmm. Anything stand out that someone brought to you and they're sitting there waiting for you to figure out what it says and you tell them and they had that look like,
not really, no.
Fair
you
enough.
Know, it was a little different from being right up with a unit in the Southwest Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it was a hell of a lot rougher war. Yeah.
Well, we want to talk more about the war and how Ike Ikeda experienced it, what he's been doing since then, and what it was like to finally be reunited with his family and to see his family try to come back from that horrible set of circumstances which it and so many Japanese-American families faced in the midst of World War II. Going to take our final break here, come back and wrap things up with Ike Ikeda here on Hometown Heroes, News Talk 580 KMJ.
Let the fireworks begin at Thomasville Furniture. Let us ignite the spark of design in your home. Between now and July 14th, Thomasville salutes our troops and our customers with savings of 40 to 44% off MSRP store-wide on all Thomasville furniture. Even Thomasville special orders will be discounted 40 to 44% off MSRP. In addition, our unique accessories will be specially priced so you can finish off your room. Act fast before the fireworks are over, and so is your ability to finance free for 1 year. The Thomasville Independence Day sale, now until July 14th. A spectacular 40 to 44% off MSRP on all Thomasville furniture. Thomasville at River Park, 110 East Alluvial, Fresno. Across from Kohl's and behind the JCPenney Home Store at the River Park Center. Also, visit us at www.thomasville.com. P.S. Congratulations to the Fresno State Bulldogs on a job well done.
Paul Everett's RV Country is expanding their body shop. Again. We've grown to 11,000 square feet, and we're introducing the most environmentally friendly water-based paint system, because nothing is more important than keeping our forest and campgrounds green. Paul Everett has been the leader in motorhome and RV collision repair for over 48 years. We employ only factory-trained and certified technicians, because whether the damage is minor or major, your RV deserves to be repaired to its original factory condition. The Paul Everett Body Shop works with all major insurance companies. For quick repairs done right the first time, check out the expanded collision center at Paul Everett's RV Country. And remember, there's never a charge for an estimate at our shop. Paul Everett's RV Country. We sell and repair RVs for less.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time always goes by way too quickly, and it has again today with Ike Ikeda, a Clovis veteran of World War II. He'll be 88 in a couple months, but you wouldn't know it by talking to him or seeing him in his bright red Bulldog Championship t-shirt. He was listening and watching with the rest of you as the Diamond Dogs won the national championship. But more than six decades ago, it was a little bigger battle that was on his mind. He was serving in China as part of the MIS, an intelligence officer, translating documents and interrogating Japanese prisoners of war.
And you talked about, you made reference, Ike, earlier to one of your colleagues who, when VJ Day approached, he was fortunate that VJ Day came when it did. Let's talk about VJ Day for you. Where were you, and what did that mean to you?
I was in South China, a place called Nanning, when unofficial VJ, which was August the 14th or the 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And then right shortly after that, there was a group of us flew into Canton, China. And we got there 2-3 days too early. The Chinese First Army was supposed to come in and occupy the city, but when we got there, they weren't there yet.
Uh-oh.
And then the Japanese soldiers were walking around town with us, some with their swords and whatnot, and we were quartered at one of the hotels there, the Oikwan Hotel, way on the top floor. So for the first couple of days, we just watched them. We didn't go down there.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, so then the occupying troops came in, you know. And so after that, we were okay. But we got there a little too early.
I imagine it was a relief for you to know that the war was over.
Yes, it was, yeah. It really was, because then mainly for the families that were still in the camps, you know, that always preyed on our minds, you know.
But then one of the immediate concerns is, yeah, the war's over, but now what? Do we get our stuff back? Do we get our property back? Can we get our business back?
Well, like us, we were renting at the time, you know, and we had just came out of the Depression, and we had accumulated our equipment and stuff, you know, used equipment, and we were just all ready to gear it up to, you know, farm good. And then when my brother and the family had to move out, he went ahead and he had to sell everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we came back home, we had to start farming by buying a shovel. We didn't even have a shovel.
Starting from scratch.
And then, too, my brother put in 2 years at the latter part of the war. He had gone off from camp to work in Chicago. And the minute he went to work, they gave him his 1A and greetings. So, but just as he was ready to go overseas, VJ came along. So he was sent to Japan during the occupation as a Jeep driver. Yeah, so he was in altogether a different unit.
But you came back and did help your family get back on its feet and get back into the farming business?
The family had moved back shortly before.
Mm-hmm.
I came home, because it wasn't until the first part of February in 1946 that I came home after I was discharged. I was discharged at Camp McCoy, Wisconsin, and my wife was living in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was waiting for me with our first son. I had planted the seed before I went overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Which I wouldn't advise anybody in the service to do that. If I had to do it over again, I don't think I'd even get married. However, you never know what life holds in store for you. It could go so many different ways.
It worked out all right for you.
Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah, I have that son that was born while I was away. He'll be 63 years old. He just retired last year from teaching after 38 years.
Mm-hmm.
He taught for 38 years, and he's always lived in Clovis. And so I'm very grateful for what life has, you know, given us.
What was that like to get back and to see your wife and to really meet your son?
Yeah, it was really something, you know, because... I got a Red Cross telegram when I was overseas about his, you know, when he was born, you know. And so, actually, I had a chance to go to Japan for occupation after VJ, but I also had enough points to come home, so I said, the heck with it. I'll go there some other time. I said, I want to go home.
Something tells me your wife would back you up on that decision, too. I want to ask you something. I want to share a personal note here, too, in a minute. But years later, and so you got back in 1946, it would be another 42 years before the government apologized to your family and 120,000 Japanese Americans who were part of that internment. When you got that letter from President Bush, the first President Bush, and the $20,000 that went to each family, what was the significance of that to you? Did that mean something?
I think more than the monetary award that was given, I think it was finally the government admitting that they had done wrong. You know, I think to me, that was the most important issue. You know, because that, like I say, it was an abridgment of the Constitution. And I don't see how America can tolerate that.
Well, hopefully it's something that, because of what you and your family and others like you endured, will never happen in this country again. I think
we can hope for that. We've tried to preach democracy around the world, and actually I've thought, how can we do that with the certain things we have done, you know, especially that evacuation? I mean, that's a black mark that I don't think it's been pretty well erased, but then it'll always be there.
Well, right, and $20,000 a family, that's a nice gesture by the government 20 years ago to do that, but no amount of money can ever give you your life back or give you what you had before they did that to you.
Yeah, because, you know, then too, certain percentage of the young fellows that decided they weren't going to join the army or fight for the country because the civil liberties have been taken away. You know, at first, we who were in the service sort of looked down upon them, but after a number of years, I've always attributed that to it was everything that they did was under duress.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that is the key word, duress, that you cannot blame them, because if you were to put anybody else in that situation, you know, you can just about imagine what the result would be.
No question. And I think it's a tribute to you and people like you that you handled it as well as you did and came out of it the way you did. And I hear, just in the brief mention you made about the 442nd a few minutes ago, I can hear that you have the utmost respect for those men who joined after their families.
You bet. Taken. You bet. I tell you, no matter what's said and done, it's the doggies that really paid the supreme price. You know, we lost some boys in the Southwest Pacific, but not like they did in Europe, you know.
Oh, the statistics on that are just mind-boggling. And if you at home want to learn more about that, I encourage you to go to that website, gopherbroke.org, and you can see Ike's story, actually, among the more than 500 Nisei veteran stories who have been archived in video form as part of that Hanashi Oral History Project that they've done such a great job with there. I want to get in a moment, Ike, what you're most proud of from your service during the war. And as you think about that, I want to share a little story with our listeners. The first time I had a chance to meet Ike was a couple of years ago. I interviewed him for a television story and had a great time doing that. And as we were leaving that story, I was admiring the 100-plus-year-old fig tree in his front yard. And I had never eaten a fig before. I grew up in Los Banos, and there are plenty of figs around. My brother would always eat figs, and I thought they were disgusting, and I couldn't figure out what was so great about a fig. And Ike pulled a fig off of his tree, and it must have been the most perfect fig you could imagine, because I took a bite into it, and now I have to admit that I'm hooked. And this is about the time of year, June, the fresh figs start coming, the Black Mission, so I just have to go buy some. And my kids think I'm nuts, and my wife does too, so I'm trying to get them hooked on the figs. Maybe they'll go to the Fig Fest with me on August 9th at Fresno State. But thank you, Ike, not just for your service to our country, but for introducing me to what's probably the food I look forward to the most now, those fresh Black Mission figs.
Well, the only problem with my trees, the starlings discovered it, and they don't leave me one fig. You know, I have four trees, and they just destroy them.
You're going to have to change that saying, the early bird gets the fig, huh?
Yeah, but then one day it'll be just a little bit green, so I, first thing in the morning I go to the tree, they beat me to it. Yeah, really.
Watch out for those birds, those starlings. Last thing for you, Ike, what gives you the most pride? Looking back on your service, what are you most proud of for what
well,
you did?
Well, you know, I tell my buddies, you know, the Nisei veterans, that I says, you know, I says, I'm proud of the fact that we went into service. It says we can hold our head up high. We don't have to bow down to anybody because we did our share. You know, we did what we could and whatever way we could. And then so I told him, you never have to bow your head to anybody. Keep your head up high.
You proved that you are just as much as an American as anybody else.
Yeah, I think that's the key word, Paul.
And your blood was just as red as theirs.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm just glad I had the opportunity to do it. And still, you know, I didn't have to go through any hand-to-hand combat and all that like some of them did. But, you know, at least we served.
That you did, and you served well, and I know that your family's proud of you, and we are too. So thank you, Ike, for your service, and thank you at home for listening to another edition of Hometown Heroes. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, you can check out the archived podcast version at KMJ580.com. That's Hometown Heroes this week on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Hi, I'm Gary Selzy, three-time NHRA world champion. I drive hot rods at speeds well over 300 miles an hour. Driving to me is not a game. Neither is hunger. It affects literally thousands of people each year right here in Fresno County. That's why I've joined the team of the Fresno Rescue Mission to help drive away hunger. When you donate your car, truck, boat, or RV, you can help those trying to survive on the streets and back alleys of Fresno. And you'll receive a tax deduction. In many cases, the donated value of your vehicle will be worth more to you than what you might have sold it for or traded it in for. The mission will fix it, clean it up, and sell it. And the proceeds will be used to provide even more hot, nutritious meals for poor families throughout Fresno County this year. You'll know you've helped drive away hunger. Thank you and God bless.
Call Rescue Mission Super Thrift Store with cars at 440-0870. That's 440-0870.
Fresno area homeowners, today's the day. 30-year mortgages are still as low as 5.8%. Now, the Fed says their cuts are over, and inflation may cause these rates to be gone tomorrow. So the big question is, how do you quickly lock in this rate to reduce your monthly payments right now? I'm Hayes Barnard, owner of Paramount Equity. We truly can deliver rates as low as 5.8% with an APR of 5.9%. We're not just a broker. We made a long-term investment to cut out the middlemen and close your loans in just 10 days. Listen, there's no better time to test our guarantee to beat any written rate and fee structure. We're going to get it done with zero out-of-pocket expenses. So make one simple call and lock in right now. I'm just so adamant we can help you. I'll even pay for your home to be appraised. Paramount Equity is committed to saving our neighbors money. Call 456-6000 today. 559-456-6000.
30-year loan, fixed for 5 years. Licensed by the Department of Corporation.
Well, it's summertime again, and I'll be dreading all those high utility bills coming my way. I think I'll strip down to my shorts and sit on the sofa and worry about all of those bills I have to pay. Hello, folks. This is Jim Salmon from Vice and Fresno Window Company. Let me tell you how to cut those high utility bills by 30% or more and to quit worrying. Call us for a free in-home estimate to replace those old single-glazed windows with Milgard replacement dual-glazed low-E windows. There'll be no stucco repair or painting needed when we finish. We can install an average three-bedroom home in one day. You'll be amazed at the different look, reduction of outside noise, and most of all, the savings on your utility bills. Hey, get off that sofa. Put your clothes on. Quit worrying. Call us today in Vicia at 651-1041, Fresno 251-6030.
Something to remember this summer. Keep your pets indoors, not only on the 4th of July, but the days before and after. Fireworks scare animals. Keep your pet close to you, indoors if possible, and away from large glass windows or doors. Outdoor pets can be easily startled, run away, and injure themselves.
Start a carpool during Healthy Air Living Week, July 7th through the 13th. You can be the solution to Valley air pollution. A message from the Valley Air District.
This is the 50,000-watt information, weather, and traffic leader. Broadcasting's News Talk 580. KMJ Fresno.
The news starts now.